Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 4:07 p.m. and it is Thursday, April 1st. I promise to avoid any April Fool's jokes in this broadcast, but I am doing the big picture long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes today because I'm observing the UK holidays, so taking a long weekend, and the next update will be on Tuesday. And as I was writing the also the big secular themes piece in here today, I was reminded of a presentation I made to the American Association of Professional Technical Analysts almost exactly 2 years ago. It was at their annual conference. And I started off with these two graphics. It was to look at the evolution of bilateral swap lines since the global financial crisis. So back in January 2007, there were official swap lines between the USA, Canada, and Mexico. And then there were also official swap lines inside Asia. So Japan, China, the Philippines, Indonesia, Laos, Vietnam, Cambodia, Brunei, Malaysia, Singapore, Thailand, and Korea all were committed to looking after one another. Or at least that they would be able to lend money to one another in extremis. And that was a, I think, a residual relationship that arose as a result of the Asian financial crisis. But then if we fast forward to January of 2009, well, then we had the financial crisis, and there were a whole slew of additional countries were roped into these bilateral swap lines. Anyone who needed access to liquidity, it was made available to them. So this big move created this artery of supply between the USA and Japan, and then there was also a big move of money flowing between China and Korea. But then we also had big moves into Canada, Mexico, Switzerland, and Australia, New Zealand, the UK. So it was a very profound move. The relationships between central banks increased substantially. Then if we look at what it looked like in 2015, well, then we have this incredible change where there is a much greater reliance on China. And China then becomes the epicenter of financial liquidity within Asia. The USA is still the big locus of attention for the rest of the world, and most particularly for the OECD. But let's just imagine what this looks like today after the pandemic, because it was affecting every country, and every country needed liquidity. Every country was cutting interest rates. Every country was boosting their deficits, and there was an acute need for additional liquidity. And that's exactly what we saw in 2020. So it's reasonable at this stage to conclude that there are probably three big locuses of supply of liquidity. You've got the USA, China, and Europe. But of all of those, the USA is currently the most active by far because it has the reserve currency. And because they have the reserve currency, they also have what is effectively a de facto standing repo facility. And what that means in simple terms is that whenever there is a liquidity issue in the repo market, the US Federal Reserve has got an unlimited liability. And when we think about unlimited liabilities, particularly when you're taking regulatory exams, they'll talk about options. And a call option has got limited downside because you can only lose as much as you put down for the premium, but you've got unlimited upside. And put options are the opposite. You've got limited upside, unlimited downside. Or at least almost unlimited downside, because obviously the price can only go to zero. Although there was obviously that example of oil prices going minus $40 back in March of last year. Well, then when we can think about What does unlimited liability mean for the Federal Reserve? It means simply that the entire world might be in need of additional liquidity because liquidity is drying up for corporations, or liquidity is drying up for individuals, or money market funds, or pensions, or countries. And they go to the repo market to borrow money. And rates could quickly then, because of massive demand, or supply of money coming in, we could see and this is exactly what the risk has been recently, that the Federal Reserve had been holding $1 trillion for the U.S. government. The U.S. government started taking it down in order to push that money out into the system. That was blowing out the rates, or the quantity of money that banks are allowed to hold on deposit. So they went looking for an alternative venue that created demand for repo, and then that started to put downward pressure on repo rates. And subsequently, the Federal Reserve had to step in and ensure that rates do not go zero. So they started extending the and widening out the number and the range of measures that the repo market and participants in the repo market can engage in. And we haven't seen anything like that for a while now. And really, we have to go back to the period around March of last year to see anything even remotely close to the use of an RRP facility. So this represents a significant additional source of liquidity. So when we think about what's happening in the market today, well, it has been well telegraphed that this massive infusion of additional liquidity into the economy as a result of the last stimulus package was going to have an effect on the repo market. We're now seeing evidence of that effect, and we're now also starting to see that the upward pressure on the dollar is starting to moderate. I'm particularly interested in the Bloomberg Dollar Index. I do think that it represents a better barometer of value for the US dollar. And the reason for that is because it ha includes the currencies that are not included in the conventional dollar index, but are nonetheless big trading partners of the USA and also major currencies. So when we look at the definition of the index, it's got the Indian rupee, the Korean won, and the renminbi. And we can then think about their respective weightings, and it's still majority euro, but instead of being nearly 50%, it's only a third. And then we can think about the fact that other currencies have also got weightings in here. And it's pausing now in the region of the trend mean. So this additional liquidity infusion represented by this pop in the RRP facility is something that is stimulative, and the Bloomberg Dollar Index is beginning at least to encounter resistance in the region of the trend mean. We have not yet had a big dynamic move, but it's been a meaningful rebound for the last 3 months, and it's a logical area where we could anticipate some resistance starting to come in. We're in an environment where we have competitive currency devaluation. And this was most acutely evident for the Japanese yen. So the yen has, or the dollar has rallied over the last 3 months to pressure the more than 5-year sequence of lower rally highs. It's a logical area where we might anticipate some support for the yen coming back in. The Japanese have so far been quite happy to allow the yen to depreciate, and just last week they said that they were willing to exercise some leeway in how much they were going to allow the JGB yield to move around. So that's a moderation in their yield curve control program, and That also has put downward pressure on the yen. It's really kind of accelerated lower over the course of the last week. It's testing the 110 area at present. So there is potential here that we've seen about as high as the dollar is going to go against the yen. But then, of course, the question is how competitive will Japan be with the USA? And will they be more willing to flood the market with additional yen in order to continue to allow the currency to depreciate? It's a big question. But one thing that we can be sure of is that the weaker the yen gets, the more of a tailwind it represents for nominal prices in Japan. Now, the Nikkei index has been pausing for most of the last 2 months, and it's unwound a good portion of its overextension relative to the trend mean. So we might yet see some additional consolidation, but the reality is that the ultimate upshot of the determination by every central bank in the world now to pursue an inflationary bias is that eventually they'll succeed. And there's probably no country would benefit more from inflation than Japan. They've been the country that's been mired in secular stagnation longer than anyone else, and they've been trying for longer than anyone else to create an inflationary bias. One thing that I think is relevant, and it doesn't seem to get a lot of consideration, is that a lot of economists tend to look on Japan as a case study and conclude that because of negative demographics, that other countries are also going to follow Japan into secular stagnation. And obviously, the difficulty that Europe is having in getting back to an inflationary bias and also to create self-sustaining growth and outpace really, I guess, to get the debt situation under control and to really start to get animation in terms of economic activity. They're having difficulty because of the negative demographics, because they failed to recapitalize the banking sector. But the other side of that equation, and what perhaps the failure of Japan to really create an inflationary bias, it's very easy to blame Japan that the policies that they introduced didn't last for long enough, that that they failed in their attempts to create inflation. But I would rather ask the question, could they possibly have succeeded when we were in one of the greatest disinflationary periods in history? And I don't think that there is an easy answer to that question, because we've been through a 40-year period of increasing globalization, increasing deregulation, and then also there has been this a lower tax rate environment for corporations has also been quite clear. So we've had this very dominant period of time where capital has won out over workers' rights, and that has also been a factor where we've had disinflation because of globalization and because of deregulation. And these have been by far the most are the greatest contributing factors to a lack of an inflationary bias everywhere. And of course, during that time, Japan was also dealing with its own debt bust, and they were going through this secular period of stagnation during a time when we had global disinflation. So, rather than thinking that it's inevitable that Europe will first follow Japan and then that the USA will subsequently follow Europe into a secular stagnation environment, well, perhaps we should be asking what happens when every country goes back into an inflationary bias? Would that be enough to shake the bias overall? And then we could have a new inflationary environment everywhere. Well, the Second section index in Tokyo continues to push back up towards the upper side of this range that's been forming now for more than 3 years, and it has historically been a lead indicator for the wider market. So while the Nikkei continues to consolidate, I think that we have to at least give some consideration to the potential that Japan will be among the countries that will be breaking on the upside. Of course, if we are moving back into an inflationary environment, then there is obviously the question about how high can bond yields go. We've certainly seen that, for example, if we look and just look at zero coupon bonds, then what we're presented with is a yield that has been rising rather steeply for the last 6 months. And when you're talking about a zero coupon, then all of the risk is in how much of the value of the money you get back when it matures. So as the yield rises, the price is falling because investors are worried about the potential that the money they get isn't going to be worth as much when it eventually matures. So they're worried about inflation. They're also worried that growth is going to return in a very clear and sustained manner, and then that will also contribute to less demand for safe haven assets like bonds. Of course, the important point is that gold also peaked around August, exactly the same time that bonds did. The big question, however, is that as bond yields rise, it puts particular pressure on debtors that have got a constant need for new liquidity. So, on the one hand, that is the unprofitable sector of the technology sector, in other words, high growth. And those types of companies, they really depend on access to liquidity, access to cheap funds, and with very low interest rates, and continued ability to source new funds at very low interest rates in order to continue to generate interest. And when we think about the success of electric car charging companies, well, I think this is a good example of those kinds of companies. They are promising that they will have earnings at some point in the future. They also are anticipating that there will be a lot more electric cars bought and that there will be massive demand for charging facilities. And eventually, they're hoping that charging facilities will be as ubiquitous around cities all over the world as parking meters are. So they're hoping that they'll still be around when all of the automotive manufacturers are only manufacturing electric vehicles. And then they are also hoping that they'll be able to make money from the demand for the charging for all those batteries that'll be driving around. In between now and then, which could be easily 5 years, well, then they are going to have to come back to the market on successive occasions. So the share has bounced over the last 3 days for the simple reason that we have additional new liquidity coming into the market. It's not simply coming through from the repo market, it's also coming through from the promise of additional support from the federal government in the USA. The Biden administration announced this week that they're going to have an additional $2.25 trillion stimulus package. It's in large part politically motivated, and the absence of a carbon tax is a direct appeal to the states that have got shale oil and gas resources. That's certainly politically motivated. The entire aim of this stimulus package is to try and blunt the populist revolution that has taken place over the course of the last few years. It might even work. At least that should contribute to less risk of social disruptions. But the bigger point is that it's going to support renewable energy, and there will be a clear determination to build new infrastructure, and that a lot of that infrastructure, some of it, of course, will go for clean water, which is to be lauded, but some of it will also go towards renewable energy. We can definitely see that the solar sector rebounded from the region of the trend mean over the course of this week. The wind sector is also steadying from the region of the trend mean. The Brookfield Renewable Energy ETF, or excuse me, fund has rebounded also from the region of the trend mean. So there is certainly a lot of interest in this additional new liquidity that is coming into the market. The IPO index has also rebounded, and so did the SPAC index. And they have all endured significant reversions back towards their respective trend means, and we're starting to now see evidence that they are firming. So this is a direct response to the additional rounds of liquidity. We've also seen that one of the announcements that was less discussed was that the moratorium on evictions was extended into May or June, depending on various states. That is an effort by the government to kick the can down the road. And of course, the longer this goes on, the more difficult it will be to end. The bigger the deficits will be, the more emboldened malingerers will be to simply n refuse to pay their rent. And this is already creating stress in the rental markets. I've been talking to a large number of real estate agents, and certainly I was talking with people in both California and in Texas. And in California, a lot of landlords are refusing to rent at all because they are worried that once the tenant takes over, they'll never pay rent. So they're waiting to free up supply. And that's, of course, is putting upward pressure on housing prices because housing is coming at a premium. Then, of course, we've had the fact that the pandemic has accelerated lots of different trends, and we continue to see the repercussions of that. Perhaps the most important, though, are the fact that buybacks have come back with a roar. So that was something that everyone thought was going to change, and it hasn't changed at all. We've had buybacks roaring back, and that is a fundamental support for stock markets generally. So that is certainly something that goes to help, I think, confirm why we've had such an impressive rebound. Now we can also think about this graphic that's been produced by Morgan Stanley. I've been thinking about it a lot. Their hunch is that as interest rates came down, business cycles were rather lengthy, and we've just had one of the longest ever. But as interest rates come up off the zero bound, then they start to be shorter. So they're anticipating that we'll have short, sharp cycles. And if that's the case, well, then we could have an environment where we get very swift bull markets, that there is a lot of rotation that occurs within those bull markets, and that the subsequent recessions are also short, but potentially sharp. I think that's certainly something that we need to begin to think about. Then there's this additional graphic that I've also been wondering about for the last few years, and it looks at cumulative Fed tightening. So, in the run-up of inflation between 1955 and about 1980, we saw that every time the Fed was tightening, they had to tighten more before the cycle ended. And subsequent to 1980, they had to tighten less. And that went through all the way until the early 2000s. And since then, we've had successive highs of bouts of tightening. So the Federal Reserve has ended its recent tightening, and it would suggest that the next time they start tightening, if this trend is going to persist, then we've been in more of an inflationary cycle since 2000, and the reality is that the inflation has occurred in assets and in prices that central banks don't monitor. So we went through an asset price bubble in the early 2000s up to 2007 in terms of real estate prices. Then we had a commodity bull market simultaneously, and that peaked in 2011. Subsequent to that, we've had a massive increase in the value of technology shares and equally in unlisted assets. So the quantity of money that's been pouring into the market has definitely helped to inflate assets of all varieties. So therefore, the big question today is whether with this change that's occurred in terms of how central banks view the likelihood of inflation, are we in fact now moving into a different kind of market where we're going to start seeing inflation in the assets that central banks do monitor? Because one of the most profound and one of the most important from a central bank's perspective is the cost of housing. So housing prices are surging higher everywhere. We've certainly seen that the S&P 500 Home Builders Index continues to trend higher. Home builders themselves continue to do well as well. Lennar Homes has also been investing in private equity, so that certainly helps to round out that argument that all manner of companies have been investing in technology firms, and we're at the point where they are rapidly coming towards exits. So there's less growth, there's more demand for participation in these kinds of assets. We've also seen over the course of the last decades that the number of or the success of these types of companies have really been predicated on less people involved in the sector. So endowments have done particularly well from investing in alternative assets. And this has also occurred against a background where, by and large, real estate hasn't been performing, at least from the perspective of an endowment. And also then fixed income returns have been trending downwards for a significant amount of time, and equities have been pretty volatile. So it's made a lot of sense for the Yale Endowment to almost completely dispense with cash and domestic equities. And the majority of their fund is invested in leveraged buyouts, venture capital, natural resources, real estate, absolute return, and foreign equity. This way of investing was adopted by Yale more than 30 years ago. Now it is prominent everywhere. There has been a mass adoption of modern portfolio theory in the asset management sector. And that means that demand for alternative assets and those that can be uncorrelated with other markets, that is the basis for modern monetary theory. So there is a huge demand for these kinds of assets among pensions. The problem is that as interest rates rise, these other alternative assets share the one characteristic that they tend to be illiquid. And it's their illiquidity is the factor that creates this uncorrelated aspect. But what it also means is that it's impossible to sell them. So it's not all that difficult to anticipate that there will be problems with these kinds of assets as interest rates begin to rise. And I think the significant drawdowns that we've seen in the IPO index and the SPAC index, and then the blowing up of the Archegos family office last week, those are straws in the wind in terms of the liquidity situation. Now, the fact that you do have the RRP facility opening up, that should act as a pressure release valve for global liquidity. So, the kinds of issues that would rise as a result of much higher interest rates will probably be blunted. We've certainly started to see that the government bond yields having rallied really very impressively do look a little tired now, and upside breaks are failing. There is a, I think, a well observable loss of momentum. When we look at that the other way around, at the futures price, there was a tail on the candle 3 days ago. It gave up most of the advance yesterday and then rebounded in here today. There's a clear loss of momentum. We've had an acceleration of the trend. We're seeing failed downside breaks, and still there's a sequence of lower rally highs, but this is increasingly looking like a setup for a type 2 bottom. And type 2 bottoms are represented by a massive reaction against the prevailing trend. We haven't seen that yet, but it's not at all beyond the bounds of possibility. And a clear and sustained move above 132 would certainly start to signal that there's the potential for a significant rebound in bond prices. Bond investors have been conditioned to both expect that they will be bailed out by the Federal Reserve, but also that buying the dips always works, because in a secular bull market, it does. As long as you're in a secular bull market, any significant pullback is a buying opportunity. And the investors that condition themselves to buy the dips, well, they come out on top. They're the ones that make the most money. And of course, success tends to breed contempt of any other strategy. So anyone who doesn't buy the dips will underperform. That only further enhances the credibility of those that do buy the dip. We've had a significant dip in the bond markets. I think investors were, there's been a lot of rationale about why bonds have been pulling back. Some have said that it's because of growth, that we're going to have a lot more growth. There's less demand for bonds. Interest rates are artificially low and they'll have to rise. So there's no need to have bonds at such high prices. There's at least some rationale to that. Others have said that perhaps it's because inflation is going to take off and bonds are allergic to inflation. So if you're going to have inflation, well, then definitely there's a rationale why you shouldn't own bonds. But I think there is an easier way of thinking about it. It's simple that you've got more supply than demand. And the reason we have more supply is because governments continue to spend and borrow, and central banks are just not buying enough of them. And when we look at the defining characteristic of the market over the course of the last 10, 15 years, it's been that the central banks have backstopped the market indefinitely. They have been the buyer of first and last resort. And that is not the condition that we had in the first quarter of this year, because the federal government was in the process of issuing well in excess of $100 billion in debt above the limits that the Federal Reserve said that they would buy, which means that they had to go to the market and find willing buyers, and those buyers were demanding a higher yield. Now we're moving into the second quarter of the year. There is less supply on the books, so there is potential for a rally. Of course, that was before announcement and the potential that we're going to have an additional 2.25 trillion in additional stimulus. And the Federal Reserve has not said what they're going to do in terms of buying that debt. But the reality is that they're not really going to have much choice, because every time there's an issue in the repo markets, they will have to supply that liquidity. And that's exactly what we've seen over the course of this last week. We've also seen that gold prices are beginning to respond. So gold firmed over the last 2 days from the $1,700 level, and it's still below the highs from the middle of March. It firmed by $100 from 1900 and then from 1800, so it's due at least a $100 rebound. That could take it up to the $1,800 handle. It might even go higher than that, but it's going to have to sustain a move above the trend mean in order to clearly confirm that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. I think that it's likely that we are close to the end of this corrective phase in the gold price, but 2 days on the upside is not enough to really confirm that. Silver prices have also begun to rebound and have at least pushed back above the trend mean in here today. When we look at the gold-silver ratio, it's quite normal to anticipate that silver underperforms in the early parts of a new bull market and then outperforms subsequently. So gold has been outperforming silver for the last couple of weeks, but the trend is still downwards. And as long as the trend is downwards, then silver is likely to continue to outperform gold. We can certainly think about the fact that during times of crisis, gold outperforms in no uncertain terms, but subsequently, silver outperforms for the rest of the bull market. And it's exactly what we've seen so far. I think it's very unlikely we're going to see silver, the gold-silver ratio, trading above its trend mean before the end of this bull market in gold. And I think that there is still clear potential that we're going to see additional upside, because we are moving into more of a competitive devaluation environment in terms of global currencies. The dollar has rebounded over the last 3 months. Now the USA is looking to print trillions in additional liquidity, and that is helping all types of assets rally. There's no discrimination in terms of the performance of asset prices, in terms of their ability to rise when central banks and governments are spending trillions. So the S&P 500 pushed on to a new all-time high in here today. The Nasdaq index has been pausing over the course of the last few months because of the impact of higher bond yields on the growth credentials of the market. With additional new liquidity, there's the potential that the Nasdaq will continue to bounce and push on to new high ground, and this is still a reasonably consistent advance. It's an equal-sized reaction, particularly compared to the one put in at the end of 2020. It has found support in the region of the trend mean in the upper side of the underlying range, so there is potential here that this is just a step in a continued bull market. The Dow Jones has been really outperforming, and it was in additional positive territory in here today. So the performance of blue chips, those kinds of companies with strong balance sheets, those that have got resilient business models, and global franchises and dominate their respective niches, those are the types of companies that benefit in an inflationary environment. And the fact that the Dow Jones is outperforming the Nasdaq and has been now for the last 3 months, that is very much supportive of the view that investors are favoring reflation stocks and those that offer a hedge against inflation. So that is also favoring the Dividend Aristocrats companies, and that has also pushed on to new high ground. It's a clear, I think, reason also why Europe has been doing better. The Europe Stoxx 600 is now right in the region of its peak over the last 20 years. This has been a profoundly long range, and it is on the cusp of being completed. It's being led higher by the DAX index, which is a total return index. It's clearly broken on the upside. The AEX in the Netherlands has also clearly broken on the upside, and is and I think it's also worth just keeping an eye on these long-term trends. The AEX has just this week taken out its peak from back in 2000. There's no doubt that it is overbought in the short term, but this is a substantial breakout to new all-time highs. The semiconductors index was up in a robust manner in here today, and it is also pushing on the upside. So we are back in a risk-on environment. There is clear evidence that this additional liquidity infusion is lifting assets of all varieties, and that is equally true of Asia. Financial conditions in Asia continue to appreciate. So this is Asia ex-Japan GDP, which has been recovering, but financial conditions are as loose today as they have been at any point since the financial crisis. So that's an additional point helping to propel growth and performance for Asia. The iShares Emerging Markets ETF has pulled back to the region of the trend mean. China represents about 40% of this index. So the performance of China's large cap companies is going to have a bearing, and the CSI 300 is now right in the region of the trend mean. The Chinese authorities are certainly intent on curtailing the power of their largest companies and bringing semi-autonomous companies to heel. Then you have the additional point that they don't want to have a market rout. So they have commanded their sovereign wealth funds to wade in and start buying shares. So that is at least holding the region of the trend mean. Then we can think about India. It's one of the primary beneficiaries of rising geopolitical tensions. So the Nifty index was also in positive territory today and continues to hold its bull market environment overall. The Vietnamese index, Vietnam is seeing its exports to the USA continue to trend higher. It's been the primary venue for companies to migrate their demand away from China. So the Vietnamese index closed at a new all-time high, or at least a high for the last decade and more in here today. And that suggests that Vietnam will continue to be favored by investors. Singapore sits on the Straits of Malacca, and that's a significant choke point in the route that China's oil tankers take from the Middle East to China. Having taken back control of Hong Kong and making its wish to take over Taiwan increasingly public, then China is also very active in creating a benign environment with the Singapore government. China has certainly got an interest in ensuring that its partners do well. And Singapore's Straits Times Index has rebounded emphatically over the course of the last 12 months, and it continues to push back up towards the upper side of its range. We could argue that despite the fact that governance is depreciating in Asia, that China certainly has an interest in ensuring that Hong Kong makes a success of itself, and the H-share index is now in the region of its trend mean. It's also at a reasonable valuation, so the forward PE is around 10. The yield, though, has come in substantially. It used to yield around 7%, now it's down to about 2%. So certainly the yield on the index has been cut back aggressively over the course of this last year. But then, of course, there is an additional point, and it is that companies like Tencent and Meituan and Xiaomi and Kuaishou have all been added to the index, and they don't pay dividends. So it's not simply that we've had dividends cut, it's that the dominant portions of the index today, they don't pay dividends at all. So that has turned it from being a rather staid value index into much more of a growth index, because of the top 10 holdings, more than half are either banks, are about half, and then technology companies are the other half. And that suggests that the H share index is going to be an interesting area to look at, because in an inflationary environment, banks should do well. There should be additional interest in the sector because banks are liquidity providers. And particularly in the USA, banks have seen that they can't lose money on PPP loans. There's been an incredible amount of commentary about the fact that vaccine producers have been absolved of responsibility for any side effects from their vaccines. But what's less discussed is that banks have been completely absolved from any of the ill effects of lending to businesses that can't really afford to pay the money back. And that's a really benign environment. What's particularly interesting is that the Global Banks Index has a striking resemblance with the Eurostoxx Banks Index, despite the fact that European banks don't represent particularly large weightings within it. And we can clearly see the commonality just by looking at the two charts. What's interesting is that Europe's banks are rebounding and they're coming off of extremely depressed levels. Japan's banks took a hit this week because of their exposure, or Nomura's and Mitsui, the largest bank's exposure to Archegos losses. But the index has also been pulling back, or it's been bouncing despite this pullback from the lower side of this range that's been forming now for more than a decade. At the other end of the scale, it was the USA's banks that recapitalized most effectively after the credit crisis, and the S&P 500 banks index is now in the region of its peaks from back in 2007. Anyone predicting that US banks would be taking out their all-time highs within 14 years of their all-time peak back in 2009 would have been laughed out of court, and yet here we are. So that is a clear example of just what liquidity can do. If we are moving into more of an inflationary bias, which does appear likely, then it's likely that banks will be among the companies that will do best because they benefit from a rising and a steeper yield curve. And the yield curve is certainly steepening. I do wonder about this contention of Morgan Stanley that we are moving into more short investment cycles. We've seen multiple examples of rotation where we initially had a big rebound in the stay-at-home sector, a big rebound in the cyclical sector, then a big round in a jump in SPACs and IPOs. Then we've had this really impressive rebound in the conventional economy. Now we're starting to see a rotation back into large cap tech. Large cap tech really peaked right around the same time that gold did. And in many respects, the argument is that it's the willingness of central banks to continue to print is the liquidity that is helping the FANG sector to do well, the SPACs and the IPOs to do well, and also gold to do well. The gold ETFs are right back in the region of the upper side of their respective base formations. So GDX started to firm in here this week. The junior gold miners ETF also started to firm from the upper side of its range in here this week as well. The other sector that has done particularly well because of this willingness to debase fiat currencies has been Bitcoin. I am a little bit more worried about Bitcoin now than I have been over the course of the last year, for the simple reason that its trend is no longer consistent. And that's the thing I like most about looking at cryptocurrencies, is that they do produce some wonderful consistency characteristics, and it makes them easy to monitor. Because Bitcoin's trend up from 4,000 to 60,000 was rivetingly consistent. It had a series of ranges, one above another. And a consistent trend is a trend in motion. So when a trend is in motion, it means that its pattern of pause and consolidation will repeat. And as long as it's repeating and rising, repeating and rising, then there's nothing to really worry about, because the forces that are creating the imbalance between supply and demand are persistent. However, when the consistency of the trend breaks down, well, then it tells us that that imbalance between supply and demand that animated the trend has changed, and it's quite likely that the change is not for the better. So Bitcoin did break its midpoint danger line stop back on the 25th, and subsequently rebounded right back to the peak, and it's now around the 60,000 level. Bitcoin does tend to be a market that is susceptible to manipulation, and we're heading into a long weekend where a lot of people will be taking vacations. So it's not at all beyond the bounds of possibility that as we go into the Easter weekend, there is going to be an attempt to push it up and through the 60,000 level, or an attempt to pressure stops and to push it down below the 50,000 level. I think it's quite likely we are looking at increasing volatility overall. What's interesting, however, is that the Ethereum price has been quite firm over the last week, and it is now right in the region of its peak around that psychological 2,000 level. It's, I think, normal to see at least some consolidation after big round numbers are achieved. Perhaps the biggest round number achieved was that Bitcoin's market cap got to a trillion. So that's a profoundly large number. What it also helps to highlight for all market participants is that we need successively higher amounts of money in order to justify successively higher prices. And Bitcoin should do well in a very liquid environment. But the reality is that it has already gone up a lot. And in terms of bang for buck, there are probably assets that are liable to move in a more impressive manner. And particularly because there's a lot of good news already priced in. But if it can sustain a move above 2,000 on Ethereum or 60,000 on Bitcoin, well, then there's the potential that we could see another leg higher. And subsequently, the upper side of this range will absolutely need to represent support if the uptrend continues to dip into the underlying ranges, then that will cause a great deal more volatility and a much more difficult trading environment overall. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish a happy Easter to all of you.